Hello, and welcome to another edition of the 66 to 87 podcast. I am your host and moderator, Tom Reed, and in just a bit, we'll be joined by Raleigh News and Observer Hurricanes writer Chip Alexander, who will give us a little idea of what to expect with the Penguins' newest free agent addition, Brock McGinn. But of course, before we do any of that, we have to introduce our esteemed panel of Penguins writers. We have Dave Molinari and also Taylor Haas, who, if I am guessing, is dressed head to toe in black like the late Johnny Cash. Johnny had the Folsom County Blues, Folsom Prison Blues, and Taylor has the Freddie Hockey Blues. Freddie Goudreau played so well here in his short time with the Penguins, earned himself a new free agent deal. He is off to Minnesota. Maybe a little more pressing matter. Cody Ceci, also a newcomer last year, who a lot of people kind of roll their eyes at when they got him late in free agency, played so well here with Mike Matheson. He has earned himself a new deal in Edmonton. We have those coming and going. Oh, by the way, one of the most beloved figures in recent Penguins hockey history may become available. There's a chance still that Marc-Andre Fleury, who was traded surprisingly to the Chicago Blackhawks and may not want to report to Chicago, could still possibly be in the mix for a possible trade with the Penguins. That is a lot of stuff we've covered. And also, oh, by the way, the Penguins haven't really done anything to address wanting to get bigger and nastier in the offseason. Gang, what is the number one priority now for Ron Hextall and Brian Burke between now and the start of training camp? Taylor, take it away.
First of all, when you were introing what the most beloved figure in Pittsburgh sports, but I thought that was you setting up the Dominic Simone signing. definitely, probably not a popular signing if you look at the internet reaction. But as far as the question, so they have a little over in projected to have $3 million in cap space, and that's with that's from cap friendly. That does have Dominic Simone down in the minors. I don't think that's unrealistic that he ends up down there. They still have to re-sign Aston Reese, who probably should get a little bit of a raise, and Zahorna. I mean he's still exempt from waivers, so you can still put him down in Wilkes-Barre if you need to. If they are tied up against the cap, but I mean, you're probably only looking at like $1 million, $2 million that they have to really work with and address any of these issues. I mean, I think the biggest need right now is replacing Ceci, just because there really isn't an in-house candidate to fill that kind of role on the right side. I mean, because Pio Joseph on the right side, that's not an option. I mean, it would be Friedman or Ruedel really on the right side. But I mean, that would probably be a really big step back from Ceci. So I would say if you could get something better than that, it just with that money that you do have in free agency.
So that's your top priority right now to get that straightened out, that second pairing straightened out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with the money they have, that's what I would do. Yeah.
Okay. Dave, take it away.
Well, no, I think that's the only realistic primary objective they could have at this point with the limited financial resources they have. You know, if they would move a Zucker and or a Pettersson, you know, that might give them the financial flexibility to do some other things. But, you know, as it is, I think that, you know, they have to try to figure out that number two pairing. I think it's possible that they will consider, you know, moving John Marino up there and say putting Ruedel into Marino's current spot along Pettersson on the third pairing. You know, if they decide to try to fill that job internally, but you know, there's still an awful lot of off season to go.
Yes.
So you know, double checked again this morning. You know, their opener is not this weekend. Hextall still has time to, you know, explore, you know, the possibilities that are out there. I mean, Fleury, I think, seems like a lot of wishful thinking on people's part. We don't know for a fact that he won't warm to the idea of staying in Chicago. We don't know that, the Penguins, if they were inclined to try to acquire him from the Blackhawks, would make the most attractive offer that Chicago would get. Until Hextall proves that he can't be taken at his word, he's been pretty clear as recently as Wednesday that, they intend to, or they expect to enter the season with Jari and DeSmith as their goalies. I mean, he left himself a little wiggle room as he always does, and wisely so. But it really doesn't sound like getting a goaltender is high on his to-do list.
We're going to get back to the goaltender in our next segment, but I want to continue on with Cody Ceci. Now, Blues fans understand, you guys correct me if I'm wrong here, until we get closer to the season, teams can go over the cap right now, correct? They can.
Yes.
Cap if they want to.
By 10%, yeah.
So here's my question on Cody Ceci. Do you guys think that they made the right play and just, look, this is the best offer we can make? Could they have done some of the stuff, Dave, you mentioned earlier, maybe in a sense giving away a Marcus Pettersson just to get him off the books, or Zucker, maybe a smaller deal? If we thought that the CC, having CC, that having him locked in for a couple more years was more important, or do you think they made the right call and just made him an offer? That's the best we can do. Taylor?
I mean, Hextall said on Wednesday, I mean, they tried, but they just couldn't make the numbers fit. And then what he got in Edmonton, he got the 3.25 million per year, which is a, step up, but he was making, I think, 1 million last year. But he also got term on that. Last offseason, he wasn't really highly sought after. He only got, the 1 year deal, and Edmonton offered him 4 years. So, I mean, that would be a tough contract to take on if the Penguins were to try to match that. And then, I mean, the opportunity to go and play with, McDavid in Edmonton. Edmonton in the next 4 years, probably on a better trajectory than the Penguins. So I don't know if that meant that the Penguins would have to, pay even more to get him to stay here. But, with the space they have, I just don't know what I guess you could have fit him in. You would have been right up against the cap, and they really couldn't have made any other moves for the NHL roster. So if that was the asking price, if they would have had to go above that, I don't know if it would have been worth it.
Dave?
Well, and I mean, there's no disputing the way he played for them this season. I think he probably even exceeded management's expectations. He was just outstanding in every sense. But he also was coming off some pretty difficult seasons when the Penguins signed him a year ago. And if you're going to make a four-year investment in a guy the way the Oilers did, you're gambling that what you're going to get is what he gave the Penguins during this past season, as opposed to the way he struggled, in Toronto, and pretty much got chased out of town. He was, the Canadian Jack Johnson 12 months ago. So, I think they can be reasonably confident, based on what we saw, that he'll be able to again, play at that level at least for a few more years. But there's no assurance. We have seen that there can certainly be a downside to Cody Ceci's game.
If we, and I don't disagree with you guys, but let me play devil's advocate and take this one level further. The other player that the defenseman they brought in last year was Mike Matheson, and part of the concern with Mike Matheson was, and I've seen this, I don't know who coined it. It might have been Sean Gentile over at The Athletic, the Mike Matheson experience, which means you're never quite sure where he's going to be. He sometimes takes some gambles, and it seemed like Ceci was a good partner for him. So not only are you losing a Cody Ceci, but you're losing a guy who seemed to be very, that really gave Matheson some comfort. There seemed to be some chemistry there, did there not, Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, and that's why, well, I mean, they started the season as the third pairing, and they ended up getting, you know, the second pairing minutes playing more than Pettersson Marino. I mean, I there's no disputing that it was a good pairing, but it was also just, I mean, a pretty short sample size to commit that much money, that much term to. So I don't know. I mean, maybe you could, there's still someone out there who could be that good fit to play with Matheson. But I mean, there's not a whole lot of money to, that they can spend to find that guy.
Dave, and the one thing you addressed a couple minutes ago, and is a great point, and to further it, there's a lot of time. There's a lot of time before the season starts. And I think maybe that the Penguins are hoping some other moves are made elsewhere around the leagues that may force teams to make hard decisions on guys. We just saw that. We just talked about this the other day with Pavel Buchnevich. Almost, I don't want to say given away, because the Rangers needed some toughness, but from player to player, there's no comparison. I mean, Marc-Andre Fleury literally given away for cap space. So maybe there will be a guy out there, a defenseman out there, that the Penguins might be able to latch on to late in the free agency period.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, and if it comes down to it, I really think you could do worse than to have John Marino as Matheson's partner. You know, Marino is coming off, I think it's safe to say, a somewhat disappointing second season. He certainly didn't stay on the same trajectory he did when he was a rookie. Not that that would have been realistic to expect, but, you know, he is pretty responsible, pretty reliable in his own end. I think that you could count on him to be a nice counterbalance to Mike Matheson's offensive instincts. I mean, you know, you don't want to harness Matheson, you know, a guy who can skate like that with his offensive abilities. You know, that's what prompted Florida to sign him to a lifetime contract to begin with. So you know, you give him a partner who can cover for him when he wants to take an offensive gamble. And, you know, I think Marino could certainly handle that role and probably still give you a little more offensively than CeCe was able to.
Yeah, and to your point, Marino's is mobile enough to get back and break up plays. You know, again, if Matheson gets caught up, could he just kind of become kind of in that way, kind of look on as like Brian Dumoulin, the second version of Brian Dumoulin, Taylor? In other words, if Matheson is going to be kind of like the Letang of that pairing, he becomes kind of in a role of a Brian Dumoulin type player.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably a good comparison, because Matheson did kind of draw comparisons to Letang with that kind of just risk-reward, just with less offensive upside. but yeah, I mean, the Mike Matheson experience, that is like a very he's either doing something incredible offensively or like turning the puck over with some ridiculous decision. But I mean, that is the Mike Matheson experience. And yeah, so someone like Dumoulin who could, I guess, kind of keep him in check or be there as, you know, kind of insurance would be.
Yes, safety net.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that phrase. Not as good as Freddie Hockey, but the Mike Matheson experience is a wonderful phrase. All right, we're just getting started here. As we said, we're going to have Chip Alexander along a little bit later to kind of tell us what to expect from Brock McGinn. And also we get into the round table. We're going to get more into the whole Fleury drama, because I know fans can't get enough of it. And it seems like it has been hanging over this franchise for like a year now. So when we get back, we'll talk about that on the 66 to 87 podcast. Welcome back to the 66 to 87 podcast, into our roundtable segment. We did not really hit this subject really hard in the first segment. We certainly will in the next segment with Chip Alexander. But Brock McGinn is one of your new Pittsburgh Penguins, kind of brought in as kind of a quote unquote replacement for Brandon Tanev in what he brings to the team. I want to get both of your guys' thoughts on this signing. Taylor, you go ahead and first.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to replace Brandon Tanev, you know, dead on. But, I mean, they did need to bolster their bottom six after losing him. I mean, and Jared McCann. The term for him, 4 years, I think that still feels like a lot for a player like this. But I guess that's just kind of what the market was going like. I mean, Hextall did say they were surprised with a lot of the prices on day one. But I mean, it's replacing Tanev, you're not going to get, you know, the exact kind of player Tanev was, but it seems like by all accounts, he's at least pretty close and decently affordable. What, like $2.4 million?
Dave, you had a tweet yesterday, I believe. Well, in podcast terms, they don't have any idea what yesterday means. But you had a tweet mentioning basically these general managers are back to where they were, just throwing money, harem scarum. Do you think after 2020, where everyone was a little bit cautious, people were just throwing money around left and right at the first day of free agency?
Yeah, they certainly seem to be that. And, you know, that's an observation that Hextall agreed with. I was a little surprised, but, you know, the first day of free agency traditionally is a day of great excess. It's why Brandon Tanev was able to get 6 years from the Penguins in the first place. You know, they were in a bidding war with St. Louis for him, and that, you know, the Blues were only willing to go to 5 years, and, you know, so Pittsburgh, you know, tacked on a six to make sure that it got him. That's, you know, you get into a bidding war like that, and, you know, prices go up and players get wealthy.
Your thoughts, more specifically, right to Brock, what do you think of the signing?
Well, I mean, he's a good bottom six forward. He's a good blue collar forward. Based on what I've seen, and probably more importantly, the people I've talked to around Carolina's team, he's, you know, pretty good at getting scoring chances and creating scoring chances with his work ethic and willingness to go into the high traffic areas, but not particularly effective at converting them. So, you know, he's not likely to be a big scorer, but he's the kind of complementary player that good teams need. And especially when you've lost a couple of effective forwards like McCann and Tanev, I think it was pretty important to go out and get somebody of that caliber for the Penguins.
Yeah, also he did score a huge goal last year in the playoffs. I think game 7 against Washington knocked out the Capitals. As our loyal listeners to the 687 podcast know, we kind of put a player each broadcast episode under the microscope, kind of look at their past season and what their future lies ahead for the Pittsburgh Penguins. Today, he's been mentioned a few times in the podcast over the last couple months. Tristan Jarry, first year last year where he was the man. The safety net was gone. Matt Murray was gone. Started 38 games, won 25, lost 9. That was pretty good. 909 save percentage, probably indicative of a really poor start and kind of a iffy ending. But boy, things got a little went sideways in the playoffs for him. Taylor, we've heard Ron Hextall more than once try to give a vote of confidence for Tristan Jarry, bringing him back next season. Right now, it certainly looks like he and Kathy DeSmith will be back. Your thoughts on his season, and what is his future here in Pittsburgh as this team tries to get one more cup run out of this aging group of stars?
Yeah, I mean, he had a good regular season, but I mean, all that matters is the playoffs. That's all we're talking about. And like you said, his playoffs, game 5 is obviously the game that stands out when he turned the puck over in double overtime. But game five, he had a pretty good game up until that point. The rest of his playoffs, like, pretty average. He wasn't that great. I feel like if Casey DeSmith were healthy and able to step in, we're probably not focusing on this too much. I mean, because most teams, they're not running with the same goalie every single game in the playoffs. They do turn to their number two at some point. Penguins really weren't able to do that because Casey DeSmith was injured. They had Max Legace, but I mean, he'd only played the one NHL game all year, and it was against Buffalo, which at that point they really weren't an NHL team. But yeah, I feel like if DeSmith were able to, you know, come in and just, you know, win a game for them, let Jari get his head right, come back in, things would have maybe gone better. We probably aren't talking about this. So, and I don't think they're in a position to make a whole lot of changes to goaltender. I mean, when you look at what the goaltender market was like on day one and all the moves that are being made, I mean, a number one is going to cost you a lot of money that they just don't have. So I think you have to ride with Jari at least to start the season. I mean, once you get into the season, if for whatever reason there are concerns about him, then you can look into a trade. But I think you have to go into the season with Jari and DeSmith, just seeing what the market was like. They don't really have any other options.
Dave, you weren't up for giving up a number one for Darcy Kuemper?
No. but, I mean, Jari would not be the first goaltender to mess the bed in his first playoff appearance, but then, you know, come back and you know, play well in subsequent seasons. Probably the thing that really troubled me about his playoff performance was the way he played in game six, because he traditionally, I mean, he had earned a reputation as an easygoing guy who didn't dwell on adversity, you know, was able to put bad games, bad goals behind him, you know, and focus strictly on what was ahead. But it was pretty clear in game six that the giveaway he had at the end of game five that cost the Penguins that game and, you know, a probable lead in the series really seemed to still be affecting him a couple of nights later. And he just had a miserable night at Nassau Coliseum when the Penguins were eliminated. So, you know, if, you know, you don't know, you know, it's possible that, you know, one game can be an aberration, positive or negative. But, you know, that kind of stood out to me only because of, you know, his reputation for being able to, you know, not dwell on adversity and focus on the challenges that were before him.
And this all is a way of leading into our second topic here in the roundtable, and it's just something that it's a ghost that that just can't seem to be to exercise or put away. Not that Penguin fans want to, but Taylor, it was a shocking. I think it was a shocking moment on Twitter when you saw that Las Vegas had moved on from Marc-Andre Fleury after all the talk, the owners wanting to keep him there. Guy wins the Vezina Trophy. He had his own Tristan Jarry moment in the series against Montreal as well. But all indications were that he was sticking around. They move him to a team that was not on his list of teams that he wanted to go to. They apparently did not even tell him. They found out on Twitter that he had been moved. Your thoughts here, is this thing really dead? Is this do you think that they find a way to keep him in Chicago, or if not, he's going to go somewhere else? Or do you think there's a chance that he still has his reunion with the Penguins?
Yeah, this year, I don't see how that would work. He makes $7 million. I was seeing some of the reaction on Twitter and in, you know, the comment section after that trade went down, because they gave him away to Chicago for nothing, and everyone's like, we could have had Fleury for nothing. It's like, no, you couldn't have. The Penguins could have taken on $7 million in salary, and Vegas was not looking to retain any salary. The reason he went to Chicago is because, you know, they could take on that entire salary. Right. Vegas was looking for a cap dump. The Penguins couldn't be that cap dump team. Now, I mean, we don't know what's next for Fleury. His agent said right after that, you know, he's going to take some time to think about his future. Again, you said he wasn't expecting it. I'm sure that's like super just emotional to have that happen. But I don't think he's ready to retire, especially not after the season he had last year. And I mean, if he really doesn't want to go to Chicago, I don't know how that's going to play out, if he would refuse to report and kind of, you know, force their hand and make Chicago make another move. But Chicago, they're also not in a spot to really retain too much salary if they do move him. And I mean, the most they could retain is half, so $3.5 million. Even if Chicago did retain half and move him again this year, the Penguins can't take on $3.5 million for Fleury for a goalie at this point.
But what if they would move? What if they would move Jarry? What if that would be part of the trade?
I mean, that would the money would work out, but then you'd probably have to pay Chicago to make that happen, because I mean, they wanted the best winning goalie, not Tristan Jarry. So I mean, you'd also have to probably give Chicago more assets. So I don't know. I mean, it'd just be really complicated. And I think, I mean, this all depends on what Fleury wants to do. He might just end up going to Chicago and being fine. So I don't know.
Dave, I certainly understand. As bad of a look as it is with Vegas, as far as treating a player the way they did it, and not having the courtesy of letting him know he had been traded before it came out on Twitter and that kind of stuff, I understand what they're doing. They were trying to clear up cap space. They have $7 million. They want to add a center or an impact forward. I don't quite understand the move as much from Chicago, given that they had to know the fact that they were not on Fleury's list of preferred teams, and it's a bit of a gamble. I guess I don't see it as much from Chicago's end of it. Help us sort that out.
Well, I think the worst case scenario for them is that Fleury would say that, you know, he doesn't want to play for the Hawks, in which case they can trade him and probably get a pretty nice return wherever they would send him. And, if he would say, okay, I retire, all they've done is gambled, a minor league forward who's probably never going to make it into the league. So it was a very low risk, potential high reward move on their part. And, I think, their chances of selling him on playing for the Hawks might be better than, we would have thought just a few days or weeks ago. They've made some pretty bold, aggressive moves to upgrade their roster, bringing in the likes of Seth Jones.
Yeah.
Jonathan Toews looks like he'll be back. I don't know that they're necessarily going to be a cup favorite, but they're not going to be a doormat either. Chicago's a pretty cool city, I think most people believe. I certainly with a passionate fan base that's developed over the last decade or so. I don't think Fleury would object to playing there. The question is, would he want to move his family again to a new city? I don't think that would be a reservation he would have had if the Knights had traded him to the Penguins. But almost any place else, I think he would have balked and said that he wanted at least a little time to consider.
It does strike me, and you mentioned the Seth Jones trade, and that is a very good point. But the Penguins in Chicago, there are some similarities there, are there not, with where they are? I think they're both trying to squeeze maybe one more cup run with a couple of their great and aging players. You mentioned Toews, and obviously the other one is Kane. I mean, they're hoping that team has definitely been in transition the last couple of years. But they're with bringing a guy like Fleury in, if he's willing to stay there, that does now give you an absolute solid established goaltender with cup experience that maybe gives you a shot at one more run.
Yeah, I mean, if rosters around the league stayed the same between now and the playoffs, which I don't think is going to happen. But no, you know, they could be a nice dark horse force. You know, it's you know, there is some talent on that team, and if they would get on a roll, you know, they could do some damage. I wouldn't expect them to win a cup, but you know, they could certainly be a factor in the playoffs if things would break their way.
So, all right, both of you guys, we'll stick with Dave and then come back with Taylor on this. If over the next couple of days, Fleury decides, comes back and says, you know what, I want to keep playing, but Chicago, I'm not going to play here. I don't want to play here. At that point, if you're the brain trust and the decision makers in Pittsburgh, Dave, do you then say, all right, we're gonna try to make a move here, even if it's moving Tristan Jarry to defray at least part of bringing this salary back? Or are you to the point where the ship has sailed, we're going to stick with the younger guy, and we'll take our chances with Tristan Jarry?
Well, I think it would be remiss of Hextall to not make a phone call, see what you'd be talking about. You know, I think Fleury, who had a few playoff adventures of his own earlier in his career, you know, would probably be more of a safe bet at this point than Jarry would, just because, you know, there's a larger body of work. But I also don't know that you would gut the franchise to bring him in. And I really do have a hard time seeing how, you know, how a deal could be made to work, because you almost certainly would have to have the Hawks retain some salary, which if they're going to do that, you're going to have to, you know, give them another nice asset or two to sweeten the deal. And the Penguins just don't have that many assets to relinquish. You know, there aren't that many good young players in the pipeline that they could afford to lose a few, you know, without really feeling the sting in the not too distant future.
Taylor, Marc-Andre Fleury says, I'm not playing in Chicago and I'm not retiring. What are you doing in Pittsburgh, who all we keep hearing is we're still in win now mode?
Yeah, I mean, to make the money work, you'd probably have to get the Hawks to retain half, which is max they can do, and then have Jarry go the other way. And that would leave you with Fleury and DeSmith, probably. And I don't know if that's the best option either. I mean, ideally, I think if you're going to upgrade the goaltending, I think it would keep Jarry and maybe get a 1B to play with him, push him and kind of be that insurance in case he does falter in the playoffs. So if they're going to go out and move assets, take on cap space for a goalie, I just think that there's a better way to go about doing it.
Stay with you, Taylor. How shocked were you by the trade?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of came out of nowhere. I think you figured Vegas would move one goalie just because of the, you know, the cap space. But I mean, to Chicago and the way they did it for nothing, how often do you see a Vezina winning goalie just given away? I mean, yeah, that was really surprising.
Dave?
I did not anticipate Fleury being moved, certainly. But you know, in this game, you never know, especially in the salary cap era. Yep. You know, teams do things that they normally would not ever have considered. But you know, you only, you know, have so much cap space, and you have to prioritize your needs. And obviously, the Golden Knights felt that they had a goaltender that they could lean on to, you know, to get them where they want to go.
Yeah, it really is, and we discussed this earlier in the week. It really is a bizarro time in the NHL with guys either given away or really lopsided trades to make money work right now. And I guess for Penguin fans, they're out there on the ledge right now with some of the early moves, as we've been saying throughout this episode and previous episodes. There's a long way to go before the season starts, and I just think there's going to be more twists in this tale of this off season with guys that you never thought would be somehow come available. So I do think you have to give the franchise a little bit of slack here and see what shakes out between now and when these guys report to training camp. All right, when we come back, we will be joined by Chip Alexander of the Raleigh News Observer. He's going to give us a little bit of breakdown. He's covered all of Brock McGinn's career. He'll tell us all about the newest Penguin on the 66 to 87 podcast. Welcome to the 66 to 87 podcast. And as we promised, we are going to be joined by a terrific writer from the News Observer down in Raleigh, Chip Alexander. Chip, how are you doing today? Lots going on down there.
Yeah, I'm still trying to recover from yesterday. We've had some slow free agency days here in the past, but it wasn't that way yesterday.
No. Here in Pittsburgh, the big question is, what are the Penguins getting in Brock McGinn? He's in some ways being kind of portrayed as maybe Brandon Tanev light. What do you see? Well, you've gotten to cover him. He's had his whole career there. What have you seen in Brock McGinn?
Well, Brock McGinn, and you hate to have favorites as players, but he was certainly one of the guys that was one of my favorites in playing here. And I think it was because the same reasons that really endeared him to a lot of the fans here, just in the way he played and the competitiveness, you know, that he had. As Rod Brendamore always said, you just can't keep Brock out of the lineup. It didn't matter if he had some injuries, big or small, if he was hurting, anything. It was just hard. You almost had to drag him off the ice if he was hurting. I mean, you see him block a shot, he'd go to the bench, he'd be bent over in pain, he'd go back to the room. You think, well, that might be the night for him. And, you know, a few minutes later, he's back on the ice. So I think that Brock McGinn, my prediction would be he'll be the same kind of player in Pittsburgh that he was in Raleigh, and that's one that the fans will really appreciate and enjoy seeing him play.
Chip, were the Hurricanes resigned to kind of losing him, or did they want him back, and do they have an in-house replacement for him?
Well, I think, you know, they're looking at some salary cap issues, just like a lot of teams were, and I think they were looking at two guys in Brock McGinn and then Jordan Martinook in re-signing them. And certainly they were able to get Martinook at a lesser price at $1.8 million a year, and Brock being offered a four-year package with Pittsburgh at $2.75 million. I think that the numbers itself dictated that that Brock was going to go to Pittsburgh. So, well, you know, in an ideal world, would they have liked to have kept Brock here and played here? Yes. But looking at the numbers and some of the things they have to do, not just this year, in re-signing Andrei Svechnikov, but next year with Martin Natchez, they probably felt like they needed to make this move. And they hated to let McGinn go. I know that had to be a killer for Rod Brendamore, but they just had to let him go.
The Hurricanes, I mean, they appear to be a legitimate cup contender. They've entered that kind of conversation of being a contender. I mean, two other, you know, big changes in losing Dougie Hamilton and Adelkovich. How big of a step back is that, do you think?
Well, you know, it's a redone goaltending duo there. It's going to be interesting. Alex Nedeljkovic, I think, kind of surprised everybody. You know, he was traded to Detroit and signed a two-year deal that pays him $3 million a year. It's kind of a head-scratcher as to why the Hurricanes couldn't pay him that kind of money. I know he was going to arbitration. You never know. He could have gotten a little bit more if he took them to arbitration. But at the same time, Waddell said he wanted two more veteran guys there, and he certainly got them in Freddie Anderson, you know, and Antti Raanta. But both those guys have had some ups and downs. Raanta's had injury problems. You just have to wonder if the Hurricanes really upgraded themselves in goaltending.
Yeah, I mean, and another move they made on day one, signing defenseman Tony DeAngelo to a one-year deal. Just what are your impressions of that move and, you know, the baggage he brings? And just what were the kind of the things he said and Riddell said in their availabilities afterwards?
Well, I spent a lot of time yesterday with Tony DeAngelo, you know, writing about Tony DeAngelo, that's for sure. Personally, I thought it was a bad move for the Hurricanes. I thought it was a risk that they didn't need to take. They considered a low risk at 1 year, $1 million. But given the backlash from the fans, from a lot of the fans in the last 48 hours since it first started leaking out that he might you know, come to the Hurricanes. I'm not sure that's the kind of misery that the Hurricanes management wanted to go through, but apparently they're willing to do that. And apparently Tony DeAngelo was able to convince everyone from Tom Dundon, the owner, down through the management chain that he was a change kind of player who had learned from his mistakes and all the things you expect to hear from a player looking for a job. But, you know, I think the consensus probably here outside of PNC Arena and the management offices is it was a bad move for the Hurricanes.
Chip, Jordan Staal had some awfully productive years in Pittsburgh at the start of his career and seemed to have a very nice season during this past one with the Hurricanes. Was there anything in particular that you think made that season possible for him?
I think in asking Jordan, I think that he stayed in the Raleigh area a lot, you know, in the off season, more so than going back to Thunder Bay and working out with his brothers and the things that he used to do. I think he changed the routine. He stayed here. He worked with the strength and conditioning coach for the Hurricanes with a couple of other players, basically stayed in his Raleigh home with his family. And it just seemed like that he came back with a renewed sense of, you know, urgency or whatever you want to say, competitiveness. I mean, he was kind of a changed guy. You know, we even kidded him. He cut his hair. He just looked different. Physically, he looked different, and he played differently. As you said, he played like a younger player. And it's almost like he, you know, it was a rebirth of sorts for him. And I think part of it, too, Dave, was that, you know, I don't think he was comfortable at first being the captain of the team, but I think he has grown into that role and has become more comfortable in being kind of the guy in the room and the guy that players can turn to. And certainly just adding it all together, Justin Williams having retired, Jordan is the captain, being in better shape, being in better condition, playing well, making the plays that needed to be played. I think it just all added up to a really good year for Jordan Staal. The key now is that was in a 56-game regular season, as condensed as it was. You know, how will he maintain it over an 82-game season this season? I think that's still a question that's out there. He is a year older. He has played more than 1,000 games, and at some point with every player, that starts to add up and affect them. But it certainly didn't last year.
That's it's just been a few years since Pittsburgh became the first team in the salary cap era to win back-to-back cups. Now Tampa Bay has matched that accomplishment and, you know, will be trying to become the first team to win three in a row since the cap came into being. You see them pretty often. You know, you got a pretty good look at them during this past season. Do you think the Lightning's capable of winning a third?
I think they are. And as everybody knows, I mean, it all starts in net with their goalie, the best in the world. So, you know, I just feel like with Vasilevsky, they've always got a chance to win, and they've always got a chance to win the cup. I mean, he's in the prime of his career, and then you add in all the other players they have, the talent. I saw today that Corey Perry is going there on a 2-year contract. That adds another veteran presence to their room. And just it seems like that they make the right moves at the right time. I know they were criticized last year for the use of the long-term injured reserve and the salary situation there. But, you know, that kind of shouldn't overshadow all the things that they've done with management and putting the team together and the way they developed some of those players. And I just feel like they're very good. You know, from the very beginning last year when the divisions were announced and Carolina was put in the Central Division with Tampa Bay with the understanding the first two rounds of the playoffs would be, you know, within the division. You just knew that was going to be a tough road to go, regardless of where you finished. The Hurricanes won the division, but at the same time, they knew they had to go through Tampa Bay, and they just didn't measure up with them. And very convincing. Yeah, if any team can do it, I think Tampa Bay can do it.
All right, Chip. Thank you so much for your insight. We're looking forward to talking to you again next season when these teams meet up, and we'll see how Brock McGinn does in his reunion with his former team. That is it for us this week on the 66 to 87 podcast. For our guest, Chip Alexander, for Taylor Haas and Dave Molinari, this is Tom Reed. We'll talk to you next time.